You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Later on, Edward's going to be talking to one of his colleagues in California about new results in supernovae, a zombie star, perhaps.
Yeah, a star that wouldn't die.
More on that later. To begin with, a few things that have been going on closer to home. We've had the first observed interstellar visitor, which doesn't mean little green men. This is an asteroid that's come flying at us.
Maybe a comet. It's actually very difficult to tell what it is. It's a very strange shape as well. It appears to be elongated. So it's very, very long and very narrow. And it's going very fast. It initially was thought to be an asteroid, a type of very fast asteroid, like a near-Earth object. And then from further analysis, the brightness of it looked more like a comet. But the thing doesn't have a tail. But then again, a lot of comets don't have tails. And the distinction between comets and asteroids has been quite a bit blurred recently. They seem to be actually more or less the same type of thing. They've just got different compositions, but made of the same stuff, just in different amounts.
And so you can have comets with no tails, you can have asteroids with tails, and so on. This one was observed coming flying in from, actually, vaguely from the direction of a star called Vega, although it's been travelling so far that Vega wouldn't have been there hundreds of thousands of years ago, so who knows where it originally came from. Swung by the sun very closely, going at, more than 100,000 kilometres an hour. And then as rapidly on its way out of the solar system again, and it was a few telescopes on Earth that managed to get a few quick snapshots of it.
Yeah, it was very, very... I tried to, with Las Cumbres Observatory, I tried to get observations of it. And actually, so did a chap called Alan Hale. And if you're familiar with the comet Hale-Bopp, he was one of the discoverers. And he was trying with our network to get pictures of this strange object. And it was very low, and we just didn't manage it. And it was only visible for a few minutes each night from all of our sites.
Yeah, very hard to observe, and so moving very, very quickly because it's come from so far in and been pulled in by the sun's gravity only to be whipped out again back in some other direction. It's probably been travelling between the stars for hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah, that's right.
It's been a very, very much a lone visitor. It's got a name. It's got a code, which is 1I-2001U1. So the 1I means the first of its interstellar asteroid.
Yeah, the I stands for interstellar.
Which is quite exciting. It's been given a name, which I'm going to let you pronounce, Edward.
It's Oumuamua.
Okay, and that's that originates from Hawaii, where it was...
Yeah, so it was discovered by PanSTARRS, which is a survey telescope that's based in Hawaii. It's interesting, the naming of these things. So you have various different types, because it was originally thought to be some sort of comet thing. It's got a comet-like name, which is normally a number, which is the number of this class, so number one of the interstellar, 1I. But there are various different periodic ones which have a P in them, like Comet Tempel is 9P, and things like that.
So it's got a name. It's been observed by a few telescopes. It seems to be spinning quite quickly. That's unusual, I guess. And you mentioned it was very, very long and thin. Other observations have said it's not quite that long and thin. It's a case of there's not much data about this.
Yeah, thing. That's right. We didn't really get many looks at it.
We're not going to get any more, right?
No.
It's now gone. So there was an estimate of about one of these a year comes through the solar system, but they're so hard to pick up that we've not seen any before, and that maybe as PanSTARRS observes more, and in the future the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope is going to survey the sky every few days, and maybe we'll find more of these things.
Yeah, it's entirely possible, particularly with the LSST. It's going to be doing this type of detective work quite routinely, we hope.
Excellent. It's more interstellar visitors, very much welcomed. Let's just hope they come in peace, of course. Slightly further afield, slightly further afield at the moment, at least, a new planet discovered. It's called Ross 128b. So it goes around the star Ross 128, which is not very far away, only about 11 light years away. So that's pretty close for exoplanets.
Yeah, that's right. It's Ross 128 is the name of the star, and that's quite unusual, or it's quite unlike the Sun. It's a very red star. So although the planet, Ross 128b, is more or less Earth-like, it's orbiting much, much closer than the Earth is to the Sun. But that still isn't a bad thing. If you put that planet in our solar system, it would be like Mercury, and it'd be very hot on one side and very cold on the other. But because that Ross 128 is so much cooler than our star, it's orbiting very close, and that's actually fine.
And who knows what the surface conditions are like. We know the mass of this planet is a little bit more than the Earth.
Yeah.
It seems to be the best guess.
Well, the temperature is, they think from doing calculations of how far away it is, that the temperature at the surface would be between minus 60 and plus 20 Celsius.
Okay, so probably a little bit cooler than the average temperature on Earth, perhaps.
Yeah, that's
right. Not too dissimilar. And there are all sorts of assumptions go into how much cloud cover there is and what colour that have reflected the surface and all sorts of things that who knows.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to infer anything about what the planet is really like from this distance with our current techniques. You really need to have a totally different type of totally different way of analysing the light to be able to say whether there's an atmosphere going around an exoplanet, which is using something called a spectrograph. And really, you have to do that from space as well. So, a more complicated method, and in space, which makes everything more complex.
Yeah. And this is a possible or a likely target for one of the first things to be observed by the Extremely Large Telescope when that comes online in 5-10 years, whenever it's built. That's going to be a 40-meter diameter telescope, so four times wider than all the biggest optical telescopes we have at the moment. And that will be able to pick out this star and its planet going around it separately, which no other telescope around is going to be able to do.
Yeah, that's actually a very big deal to be able to distinguish. Normally, you have the light from the star and the light being reflected from the star but off the planet, or the shadow of the planet passing in front. They're all merged together in the light that we see from that general area of space. So being able to distinguish the two different lights will tell us an awful lot.
So, watch this space in about 10 years' time for when Extremely Large Telescope is online, perhaps. Coming a little bit back close to home, the nearest star, so I think Ross 128 is the 13th nearest star that we know of. The nearest star, Proxima Centauri, also has a planet going around it, Proxima B, discovered last year, the year before?
I think it was last year.
And these planets all blur into one.
Yeah, that's right.
But now, observations with the ALMA telescope, a radio telescope in Chile, has found a dust ring going around as well.
Yes, that's right. And actually, possibly evidence of two dust rings. And this is quite interesting. It's probably material that's left over from the formation of the planet that we found, Proxima B. And it could have all sorts of implications for the way that we understand how planets form. Because this is, I think, the first time we've seen a dust ring and a planet are going around a star.
I think certainly with a terrestrial planet like this, and because Proxima Centauri is only 4 light years away, this is something that in the not too distant future we can hope to try and observe in much, much more detail. So very, very interesting prospects for.
That's right. Also, with dust, you don't really need an awful lot of dust to be able to see it. Dust is actually very good at shining light that this type of telescope, the ALMA telescope, and other telescopes of this sort can see and pick up. So actually studying this at such close quarters, we could actually get a really good idea of what's going on there.
Yes, and we might even learn more about how planetary systems form around these kind of stars, which is something we're always looking for more observations of, more data of as well. In cosmological terms, what else have we had? We've had a detection of more black holes from LIGO.
Black holes.
Yeah, more again. There's no big press release of this one. These were just sort of slipped out in the It is a new discovery. It was discovered back in June, so the 8th of June. This is the lightest pair of black holes been seen to merge by LIGO. That's sort of the interesting thing about this pair, I guess.
And that's actually the mass of black hole that everybody was expecting to find when LIGO first switched on. Not these black holes with around 30 times the mass of the sun, but these relatively small ones, which are 9 or 10 times the mass of the sun. And actually the wonder of science is we were totally surprised by finding these big ones first. And now, fortunately, we've found some smaller ones, because those are the ones that really we were expecting to see. And if we hadn't seen them, that would have been actually probably a bit worrying.
And they're a bit hard, because they're less massive, they're harder to see in the LIGO and the Virgo data when Virgo, the third detector, is online. Because they're lighter, less massive, we also think there are more of them. And so with the next observing on due to start in about a year or so, then there might be many more of these seen. So it'll be interesting to see how many of them there
are. Yeah, that's right. Because they're supposedly more common, they're hopefully quite a lot of them close by. And so if they are relatively close by, then the signal is going to be brighter, just like a star being closer.
And of course, we do have, we'll talk about it in the future, but we do have a project for schools to go and try and follow these things up using collaborating between us in LIGO and you in LCO.
Yeah, that's right. I'm very much looking forward to that starting sometime in the new year.
We'll update on that in due course. Now, on to the main part of this month's episode, and you've been speaking to one of your colleagues.
Yeah, so earlier I spoke to a colleague of mine, Yair Arkavi, about the star that would not die. Unlike me, Yair doesn't spend his days sitting under the cold and rainy Cardiff skies. Yair lives in California, so I only get to see Yair once, maybe twice a year. Hello, Yair.
Hi.
So I'd like to talk to you today about this exciting discovery that you recently published about the star that wouldn't die. So you are an astronomer and you specialise in supernovae. And so this star that wouldn't die, you started off observing it like you would any supernova. Can you maybe tell us what you normally do when a supernova is discovered?
Yeah, so we are partners with different surveys that survey the sky and look for things that change. Among them are supernovae. One of the biggest surveys we collaborated with is called the Palomar Transient Factory. It's run out of a telescope at Palomar Observatory in California. And they survey the sky every night or every clear night. And it was a very effective survey. They found about 10 supernovae a night. So it was, in fact, a little bit too effective in that we couldn't actually follow every supernova they would find. So we'd have to choose the ones we thought were the most interesting and kind of let most of the other supernovae just go unfollowed, unexamined.
That's a real shame, actually. But, I mean, you've got to pick your battles, I suppose. And so how do you make the decision which ones to carry on and follow up and which ones to leave for somebody else?
Right. So we're depends what we're interested in at the time. So when this happened, and still today, we're mostly interested in very young supernovae. So supernovae that are discovered very close to when they exploded, very close to when they went off. So say hours or just a few days after explosion, that's something we would definitely follow.
So you do this quite routinely, and at any given time, you're following around 20 supernovae, is that right?
More like 40 or 50.
Oh, wow. Okay. So a lot of supernovae, keeping track of each one, maybe getting observations of them every day or so.
Yeah, for the ones that are still young, we get observations every day. As they get older, they start to change more slowly, so we can get observations every few days, and eventually when they're really fading, we'll get observations maybe once a week or once every couple weeks until we can't see them anymore.
So you keep track of all of these different supernovae over time. And this particular one, which is called IPTF-14HLS, which is a bit of a barcode name. So do you refer to that as HLS, by the way, or how do you refer to it?
Yeah, unfortunately we do. I apologize, we don't have a better name. We just call it 14HLS among ourselves. Okay.
Yeah, and so you were just treating this as a normal supernova, like you would. You'd monitor it for a few days, and you were waiting for it to start fading a little bit. And it did something surprising.
Yeah, actually, this one, when it was discovered, it was already fading. And so that told us it wasn't young, because it had already reached its peak luminosity, and it was already beyond that and was getting fainter. So this was actually initially one of the supernovae we let go, that we ignored and said, oh, this is just some old supernova that's getting faint and we don't care about those really. We can't follow all of them, so we'll have to just let this one go. And we did, and we never looked at it, or we didn't look at it for about a month or a few months. And then I had an undergraduate student from UC Santa Barbara working with me, and one of the things I asked him to do was to go back and look at the events that we had kind of let go and see if they were doing anything interesting. And when he looked again at 14HLS, it had gotten brighter again. So it was indeed getting fainter at the beginning when we found it, and then a few months later it started getting brighter again. And he showed this to me, and I was very surprised, because that is very unusual. We've never seen a supernova do that before, and that's when we started following it.
And actually, it didn't just do it that one time. It did it for a long period of time. It's actually, you've been following this for nearly 3 years. I can remember being out in California on successive summers, and you were still tracking this supernova.
Yeah. So that it first caught our attention when it got brighter after getting fainter. But then as we kept following it, it did that four more times. So it had five different peak luminosities where it got bright and faint and bright and faint again five times. And that we had definitely never seen anything even remotely like that before. And this was all happening over the course of a few years. So that as well was unusual. Supernovae typically only get bright once and fade. And after a few months, we don't see them anymore. So this one just kept on going and kept on kind of getting rejuvenated and getting brighter again and getting fainter and brighter again. And so we just kept following it as long as it was visible.
And actually, that's one of the nice things about Las Cumbres Observatory, because you can do this long-term monitoring of something like this, which other observatories wouldn't be able to do in quite the same way.
Exactly. Getting data every few days for 2 or 3 years would have been impossible with any other observatory. So one of the reasons we've only now discovered this kind of supernova might be related to the fact that we just couldn't do these observations before.
Oh, that's really nice. So now this star that wouldn't die has actually finally died, you think?
Well, I'm not making any bets here. We've thought this before and it came back. So it has been fading for the last year, but very slowly, much slower than typical supernovae fade. So even now that it's eventually fading, it's still taking longer to do that than any previous supernova.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this is a really odd beast. So what have you learned about it? How does it fit into the model of supernovae that you normally study?
Well, overall, the short answer is it doesn't. There is no model of supernovae to date that can explain what this supernova is doing, which is strange because on the one hand, it has this very weird behavior that gets faint and bright multiple times. On the other hand, when we take the light and split it into a spectrum or split it into a rainbow, that kind of gives us the fingerprint of the type of supernova it is. And when we do that for this supernova, it has the same fingerprint as the most common type of supernova, which we call a 2P supernova. That's the one we've seen hundreds of them or thousands of them in the past. And every time we've seen a supernova with that fingerprint, it was bright for 100 days and then faded and disappeared. And this one has the same fingerprint, but much different behavior. So that makes it even harder to explain. All the 2Ps we've seen, all the type 2P supernovae, were the collapse of a single very massive star, about 10 to 15 times the mass of the sun. which collapses and then explodes, and we think we can explain it pretty well, and computer models can reproduce what this looks like. But we've never seen something with that fingerprint do what this supernova is doing.
So what could it be? What could be going on with 14HLS that makes it do this sudden brightening and then dimming over and over and over?
Yeah, so one thing we thought about is if the star is exploding and then this material that's flying out is colliding with shells of material that the star might have expelled before exploding. So if the star expelled shells of material that are moving slowly and then explodes into that, every time the material from the supernova, which is moving very fast, runs into one of these shells, it could give you a bump in luminosity. But when that happens in other supernovae, that material is running into other material, we see different signatures. We see certain signatures in the spectrum. We see certain signatures in X-ray and radio light. And we've seen none of those in this case. So we're not sure if it's some kind of different way for material to collide or if it's just something else entirely. And there's another weird thing about this supernova that we found it in an old image from 1954 that just happened to be taken of that galaxy, and we see the supernova going off then. So even the weird stuff that's going on now is not the first time this thing has exploded.
Well, that's quite amazing that 60 years ago, this astronomers may have seen this supernova and think, oh, well, that's a supernova. And just think how different the research landscape, what we understand as supernovas, is now compared to how it was at the time. And actually, this event is such a completely different thing to the majority of supernovae that you normally study. It's quite mind-blowing, really.
Yeah, the more we kept observing it and the more people we asked about it, the more confused we got. And we ended up publishing the paper without actually knowing what it is. So we're just asking the community to try and come up with ideas of how we can explain this strange behavior.
So there's one of those ideas which sounds very exciting because it involves antimatter. Is that right?
That is right. So this is called the pulsational pair instability supernova. It's so far only a theory which says that the very massive stars, about 100 times the mass of the sun, can get so hot in their cores that the energy in the core can actually turn into matter and antimatter. So photons would turn into electrons and anti-electrons or positrons. And when that happens, that energy suddenly is turned into matter, and the star, which was relying on that energy to hold itself against gravity, suddenly collapses and gets even hotter. And that can trigger an eruption that can throw out the outer layers of the star. Once it does that, the star can then expand back out and kind of stabilize. And so it can do this multiple times where it gets turns energy into matter and antimatter, starts getting compressed, blows off the outer layers, and reaches equilibrium again and settles down. And it does this again and again. It would be ejecting these shells of material, and then eventually it would collapse completely and explode, and that explosion would be happening inside this array of shells that it had ejected before, and that can happen decades apart. So it could be that the 1954 eruption was actually just one of these shell ejections that left the star intact, and now it exploded into a bunch of these. But there are some problems with that idea. First of all, we don't expect to see any hydrogen in stars like that. They should lose all their hydrogen because they're very massive. And if that 1954 explosion was the first one, that should have gotten rid of any remaining hydrogen. But we see a lot of hydrogen now in 2014 and 2017. We still see a lot of hydrogen. So somehow it didn't get rid of all the hydrogen, or it somehow retained some hydrogen after the first explosion, and the theory can't explain that. And also, the energy we measure from the explosion is a few times larger than the energy that the theory predicts for all of the explosions a star should go through in its life, we measure more than that in just the latest explosion.
Wow. Well, this thing is really not fitting into any box at all. It's really resisting all the different models that you're trying to throw at it.
Exactly, exactly. And this is why we like it so much. It's the best thing that can happen to us.
Well, I mean, that's one of the amazing things about science as well. You know, you look at a thousand things that all look the same, and if you throw away them all without looking at them, you know, how many other things have you thrown away which were just like this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we're actually worried about that a bit because, as I said, the fingerprint, when you take a spectrum, looks like any normal supernova. And even this one was known to other research groups, and they saw that spectrum, saw that fingerprint, and said, oh, this is a normal type 2P supernova, and moved on. So it's definitely possible that it happened to us in the past, and we've missed a few of these before. So now we'll definitely be keeping a closer eye on these supernovae which we think are normal at the beginning, but maybe turn out to be one of these.
Well, there's so many questions that this has thrown up. I'm sure you're going to be kept busy for a long time. Yaya Arkavi, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
So this supernova story was quite intriguing. It's billed as the zombie star in some of the press. It's probably a little bit...
Yes, that's right. It's a little bit of a misnomer because I think there was a story with an actual zombie star a few years ago. And so all of the scientists were very keen to distance themselves from it being a zombie star, because the zombie star actually implies that it dies and then comes back to life in a strange way. But actually, this is the opposite. It's a supernova which actually hadn't gone supernova. Right. It had had multiple explosions and the star remained intact. So it's very, very strange. I'm really... And it's very interesting to hear Yaya put his hands up and say... Yeah, we have no idea what's going on here. We're just observing this thing to get brighter and then dimmer and then brighter and then dimmer over and over and over. And we just don't know. We need input from everybody to find out what this thing is.
It's weird. So we've had our first interstellar visitor. We talked about the star. We've had this star that won't die. There are all sorts of other single events that are odd. There's the star called Tabby's star, this star that flickers in brightness in weird ways that
no one
really understands as well. There's the odd object out there. It's just really, really intriguing.
That's right. In fact, listeners at home might remember Tabby's star for its more famous name, the alien megastructure.
Yes. we're not saying it's aliens, but it's not aliens.
No, it's definitely not aliens. But there are various things like that out there. Like there was a team in Leiden University that saw an exoplanet with giant rings around it because they inferred the existence because they saw the light from the star dimming in really strange ways. Actually, very similar to the way that Tabby's star does as well. Although Tabby's star, they don't think it's rings; they think it's sort of something surrounding. In a three-dimensional thing, not a flat thing.
Mm. And there's other thing. I mean, this is part of the problem with a lot of the time we see these things just as a point of light that gets... All we can measure is its brightness and possibly its colour or its temperature or a couple of other properties. We can't zoom in and see these things for real. So you're basing this on sort of limited data and having to infer what's going on based on our understanding of what these things might be. And if we have no idea about that, then we're completely...
Yeah, that's right. And you can't go there. I mean, like with the gravitational waves as well, this is something that you get one shot at that thing and you collect as much data in as much detail as possible, but that's it. Mm. You know, that thing has happened. And if you're lucky, you'll see another one that's very similar to it. Or if you're even luckier, that thing will happen again with the same object, like it did with the star that wouldn't die. Mm. For another take on some of these stories, have a look at the Space Scoop website. A few of our stories have been covered there, and that's at spacescoop.org.
Don't forget, full episodes available at pythagastro.uk. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.